A lot of what we do isn't very deep. So we like to pretend we're doing all the right things. We do yoga and we do, you know, we go for a run and all those things and we eat well. But we're not really attending to the deep-rooted issues. And then I found out actually that all of my clients were the same thing. So they were doing the yoga and the Pilates and all the other things, you know, having avocado on toast and all the things that you do. But actually they didn't have periods. They couldn't sleep. They were angry or stressed all of the time. And I also really recognized that was what had always happened to me. I was constantly feeling stressed. I didn't deal with that. I tried to meditate and breathe and go for a run. And they worked for the moment, but they didn't really help me long term. They didn't really change me. And I was really interested in that long term sustainable change.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today, we welcome Naheed Debelzion. She went from the brink of burnout to becoming the nervous system whisperer, a journey that taught her the transformative power of somatic movement. Over 2 decades of experience and research led her to develop the human method, her approach to rewiring the brain through movement. Naheed's work has featured in Oprah's newsletter, Maria Shriver's Sunday paper, The Times, The Sunday Times Style magazine, The Guardian, Bazaar UK, Grazia, and many others. Today we get some practical advice on right now how you can ease anxiety and how smashed avocado on toast and yoga for self-care is just not going to cut it. Naheed, thank you so much for coming on This Is Powerful.
Thank you so much for asking me.
I'd love to know your story, where you're from. How was your upbringing?
I come from quite a volatile family background. And I completely understand that no one meant that to happen, but my parents weren't really taught to self-soothe. So they didn't really know how to pass it on. And so it's a very stressful household. You know, there were immigrants here in the 60s. They had no safety net. And so although they had very nice middle class jobs, it was quite tough then to bring up kids in London. We were born and brought up here. But, you know, thank heavens we were, because I can't quite imagine what it would be like in other parts of the country. But as a consequence of that, I had chronic anxiety. The messaging that I grew up with was that you just work your way through everything. You just strive. And so I kind of think I didn't think that I deserved to rest at all. I kind of have literally worked myself to the wall. So I had chronic anxiety. I couldn't get on the tube because I was too anxious about going underground.
Was this later on when you was working, or did you have that when you was younger?
I had that when I was younger, yeah, because the house was quite turbulent at all times.
Did you know that was anxiety then?
I would have known that I was quite nervous of the world, so I was a bit anxious about something bad about to happen. And I think most people, when they come from traumatic backgrounds, they catastrophize very quickly. Even now, you know, something happened the other day where the dog ran out and my very first thought was like, oh my God, he's dead. Even though I'm an adult and I had all of the other mechanisms and strategies to understand that he isn't. Yeah. I think it was such a default setting that something bad is going to happen. There was a lot of suppressing of feelings because my mum brought us up on her own for a bit as well. And you know, when your mum does that, the last thing you want to do is bring her problems, right? Yeah. You don't talk about anything at all. And neither did she. She just kind of powered through everything because that was the way to survive, really. And so I kind of learned from a very early age that your feelings made you weak, so you wouldn't show them. And I thought rest would make you lose all ambition. So I didn't do it. And then, of course, in my adult life, that led to urticaria, which is kind of like a nervous sort of rash. It's kind of like some sort of skin kind of thing that used to erupt. Lots of itchiness when I felt a bit anxious or unsure. And then I had neuralgia, which is kind of an inflammation of nerves in the brain. It feels like a really electric burnout. Wow. And you can kind of feel it in your brain. I've burnt out several times. And I think the thing that made me change everything was that I almost died of a gangrenous appendicitis because I just didn't listen to the signals. It was just that push, push, push. I thought I could breathe my way, downward dog my way through it.
How old was you then? Because that's really painful. I had appendicitis, but not gangrenous.
Yeah, so I didn't actually understand it was that. I just felt very, very ill one evening. And then a friend of mine said, appendicitis starts here and then it moves over to the right. So I just repeated that to the doctor so that I'd get seen. And even in hospital, they kept saying, no, it isn't an appendicitis. You know, we don't think it is that. And then I got sort of rushed in and had to have an operation. And then they actually said to my husband, you nearly lost her.
Wow.
And that took 3 months of getting over. But what was interesting about that is that all throughout my life, I've been very physical. So I understood that the way to kind of help to get through my feelings of anxiety or stress or whatever it was to move. So when I wanted to leave home, I started running. When I wanted to leave my first husband, I started kickboxing. And then when I wanted to leave a very stressful technology job, I got into yoga. So movement really helped me. So here I was, 3 months, not being able to move at all. And I had to kind of really dig in a different way, go much deeper to kind of get myself out of that real downward spiral of where your self-image is made up of what you can physically do. And so when you don't have that, you have to kind of think about other ways that you can get out of bed again. I mean, you know, I had no muscle tone at all. I had no middle. I couldn't even roll over.
It's a long time.
It's a long time, isn't it? And I was also running my own studios in central London, which was yoga and Pilates and fitness studios. So I was the boss. And the thought of going back absolutely horrified me because I just thought I can't do anything for myself, let alone manage a whole crew. And, you know, as you know what it's like when you're running your own business is you're the person responsible for churning people in through the door and for paying people and paying all the bills. So it was incredibly challenging, made me kind of think about how I wanted to live after that. So when I did get better and went back to work, I remember thinking, I'm going to sell these studios at some point. I don't want to continue doing this. I kind of realized as well that a lot of what we do isn't very deep. So we like to pretend we're doing all the right things. We do yoga and we do, you know, we go for a run and all those things and we eat well. But we're not really attending to the deep-rooted issues. And then I found out actually that all of my clients were the same thing. So they were doing the yoga and the Pilates and all the other things, you know, having avocado on toast and all the things that you do. But actually they didn't have periods. They couldn't sleep. They were angry or stressed all of the time. So it kind of led me to think and delve a little bit deeper into what actually is going on, because this isn't a surface thing. And so I studied the master system, which is the nervous system, and kind of found out more about that. And what's so interesting about that is your nervous system is your brain and it's your spinal cord and it's all the communication from that into your organs and your body and then back from your body and organs into spinal cord and your brain. So it's this ongoing communication that's happening. And once you tune into the signals that your body's giving you, then you get to be in a much better relationship with yourself. So way before you have the thought that you're feeling stress, your body will respond first.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fascinating. And I also really recognized that was what had always happened to me. I was constantly feeling stressed. I didn't deal with that. I tried to meditate and breathe and go for a run. And they worked for the moment, but they didn't really help me long term. They didn't really change me. And I was really interested in that long term sustainable change.
I did it for years as well. I tried to do, well, I did do yoga and different things, and it never kind of hit the sweet spot for me. But that was because I had addiction. Until I looked after that. And I've studied lots of things. And I studied a martial art called Pakwa. And they talk about the dentian being the first brain. So yeah, you react and then you think about it. And that struck me as well, because it's like you get a gut feeling and then the brain almost says, well, why is this person giving me a strange, eerie feeling?
Absolutely.
So it's the body's really intelligent.
The body's incredibly intelligent, and now neuroscience has kind of caught up with, you know, with the body.
Catching
up. So you have neuroscientists who are now moving towards somatic movement, and I come from movement end, moving very much towards science. It's really important for me to understand why things work, because otherwise I'm absolving all responsibility for myself onto somebody else, and they tell me something. And I just have to believe it. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's probably the problem or the issue in the wellness world, is that we absolve all responsibility for our own health and our own mental health as well onto other people. And we don't get a good understanding of that for ourselves.
It's easy to pay to go to a yoga class and think you're doing something right for yourself.
Absolutely.
And easy to pay to go and see a healer.
Exactly.
But not many people do what you've done. Probably because you couldn't move anyway, gave it the opportunity to...
I had no other option.
Yeah.
And actually, that's really interesting you saying that, because I also think that our culture has groomed us to really mistrust our feelings.
Mm.
And it does that because we're easy to manipulate and we're easy to sell things to. And there's a real cognitive dissonance in that, because your body senses something, but your brain makes a different sense of that based on the messages that you're getting. And that's what I think causes that real conflict in people. And certainly that's what I see in my clients, is they're told to accept the life that they have, but they have this really deep-rooted kind of underlying ill at ease with it.
Yeah.
And that's what I think causes the kind of big issues with people, of where they're not feeling themselves.
I have a lot of friends that are, who went to private school, that was told that it's all about, you know, strength of the mind, strength of the brain, rather. Mm. You can always see how people overexert themselves or have to become powerful. And there's a different feeling of being powerful or being happy and content, isn't it? It's a completely separate thing.
Mm.
I never knew what it was, because I thought being wealthier or more famous or something was the feeling of being happy, and learned firsthand that it's completely different.
Yeah, so I kind of think it's a difference between self-belief, which is a made-up thing, isn't it? I'm the big I am. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of this clip-on thing that you pretend, like, look at me. And this really deep-rooted confidence in who you are, which I kind of think I found with this somatic movement in a way that I never had in my life. So I did the running and I did all the things, and, you know, and I had quite a big job once in technology. And so I had all the trappings that I'd never had before. And I thought, exactly like you, thought, yeah, great, this is it. And I was still really unhappy. It didn't really fulfill me, because actually the foundation of who I was hadn't really been resolved, hadn't been given a voice, if you like.
Why did you go into yoga? Why did you open studios from your previous job?
I actually have had four different careers. So I went to art school and I was in fashion for quite a long time. Then I started up a women's magazine for a bit with two other women. Then I went into technology, and then I'm now in wellness. I think throughout my life, movement has been my theme, if you like. So my continuum to help me to mitigate my emotions in some way. I got into yoga, I think, because people told me that I should.
Right.
And I thought, right, I ought to do this. But before then, I was running and kickboxing. So I like really hard sports.
Yeah.
But it was in technology company that was just insane. It was at the beginning, just at the beginning of the World Wide Web being launched, which sounds like a really long time ago. So it was really incredibly exciting and very fast moving. And everybody in the company, they were nuts. They were all on drugs. It was kind of, it was a startup. Lots of money was being thrown into them and everybody was taking something. It was just insane and being paid a lot of money to do it. And I remember when I finally left it, I mean, it was super fun, but not at all sustainable. Mm. And then when I finally left it, I just thought, what am I going to do? I had no plans at all, which is kind of quite typical me. I kind of work on whims. And I thought, right, I'm going to book myself onto a yoga retreat. And I took my husband because I didn't want to share a room with somebody. And I said, you don't have to do it, but I'm, you know, you can do whatever you want, but I'm going to try this. And I did it. And it was really quite amazing. And what often happens when you're doing any sort of new movement and you really immerse yourself is that you get very evangelical about it, don't you? It's kind of like the next thing.
That's so well said.
It's kind of like it becomes an obsession. I kind of feel like we replace obsessions with obsessions, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, of course, yoga was the answer. But I think what actually was the thing that really resonated with me was having a week away in deep work. I think actually it was probably that. And moving, of course, which helps to move the cortisol out of your system, helps you to make sense of yourself and gives you something else to think about. You sit with your thoughts. You can kind of problem solve in a much more easier way than you can when you're at it at work, you know, with no let up.
Yeah.
So it was brilliant and amazing. And I thought, oh, yeah, of course, I want to teach this. Actually, no, I didn't think I wanted to teach it at the beginning. I was doing a lot of yoga and freelancing. And then I actually heard about the power plate and I missed my muscle tone that I used to get in the gym. So I thought, let me go and have a go on that. Loved it. And I set up the first independent power plate studios.
Did you? Where
was that? UK. It was in Covent Garden.
No way.
On Betterton Street.
Wow.
So that's how I got into having fitness studios. Didn't think I was going to teach yoga to anyone at all. But then as I had the power plate studios, I was like, actually, I'd quite like to teach this as well. So then I expanded into yoga and then we did Pilates reformers and so on. So it was all a bit of an accident. It kind of all evolved from one thing
and
to another.
And early on in
really
that whole
early
thing,
on,
yeah.
Really early on. So we were in Covent Garden. Then I ended up having about four different studios, one not very far from here, actually.
Amazing.
Yeah. And it was great. You know, it was really fun, you know, as ever, when you start things off, they're super fun, aren't they? And then when you have to manage them.
I was going to say, it's different from.
It's so different. And when you're running studios, it's, you know, as I was saying, it's just about churning numbers through,
you're managing,
isn't it?
And trying to pay
exactly.
The bills.
And I remember one day being in an office just thinking, I don't see anyone. This is really lonely. And the two things I love are people and chatting. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It kind of really removed me away from those things. And I remember thinking, I've got to go. So I was on the retreat and I came back and I was like, I can't do this anymore. So I sold it, luckily. And then COVID happened, of course, and we all went online. And actually, it was brilliant for me because I could really get into this very deep somatic work. And what was so great about it is that if you were my client, you don't have to travel somewhere. So, which means that, you know, the busy people can fit it in. You're not watching the screen. I'm guiding you and I'm watching you to see how you respond. Mm. And then you have your own space to kind of process that. So you don't suddenly have to get on the tube and, you know, kind of face people again. So actually it worked out really, really well for me.
I'd love to know when you discovered a physical feeling sensation of not being anxious for the first time to take you into that journey. Because that's a big key thing for me anyway, because I always said that my body was like, felt like shattered glass.
Yeah.
I was always on like fight or flight or freeze. And my mind was unbelievably busy.
Yeah.
And I could never turn it off. And when I had my first experience, I actually wept for 2 days because I couldn't believe how, I wouldn't say tortured, but pretty much my mind was prior to that experience. And that experience alone gave me the drive to go into all the work I do now, basically. When was your first experience with?
So I'm trained in Feldenkrais as well as lots of other somatic movements.
What's that for our guests?
So Feldenkrais, is named after somebody who had developed this method that was kind of used all his experience and knowledge about being an engineer, and he was a black belt in judo. To fix his own knee, which I think he would have needed surgery. And in those times, you would have ended up in a wheelchair. So he kind of applied all of that. And he sort of also was into Eastern philosophies as well to kind of fix himself, if you like. And so it's a way of organizing your nervous system. And it starts at the beginning of the movement process, which is your brain. And you then end up affecting the end of the movement process, which is muscle. And you problem solve. So you're guided by somebody and then they kind of go, well, let's get you to reach over here. All right. And now Paul, do it like this, and then do it like that,
It's physical guidance.
It's physical guidance. It's exactly how babies learn to be in their, you know, environment.
Yeah.
So, you know, when your kids were babies, you might have seen them kind of on their back, putting their foot in their mouth and laughing and then trying it again.
Yeah.
And then they did it again. Then they found out they could roll over to one side. And then they either cried or they laughed and they came back. And then they figured out how to roll onto their side and then onto their bellies. And then they figured out where their caregiver's voice was coming from. So they'd lift up their head. And then they'd figured out how to crawl towards that person. So we learn by experience. And so this method completely, you know, uses that idea of developmental learning to change and rewire your brain. And I'd met it about 25 years ago, but of course, being a bit of a speed freak, I understood it intellectually, but I kind of thought, don't know, this isn't for me at this moment. But I was always drawn to it. And all of my teachers, unbeknown to me, had been influenced by this method. So I went off and trained in it. It's, you know, if you carry your shoulders up here and suddenly you experience your shoulders down here, but you haven't stretched, it's really important. It's not stretching. It's releasing from your patterns.
Mm.
And there's something quite incredible about that because it speaks to you under the layer of language. So your body understands it. And when your body understands it, your brain gets really curious about it. So I'd met it several points throughout the way, but I was still probably drinking, you know, wine or having a bit of a puff or do you know what I mean? So I had a library of things that would help me feel a bit relaxed. And I think I probably didn't understand, I wasn't able to discern, actually, this is the thing that is making me feel really different consistently. So when I studied it, I was like, okay, this is incredible. I'm having such epiphanies. Here's the thing that I find so fascinating. Your self-image isn't made up of your cognitive mind.
Okay.
It is made up of all your other senses. So the sensations that you feel, and they go on to form your emotions. Your emotions go on to form your thinking, your thoughts. Your thoughts go on to form your actions, and your actions go on to form your long-term behaviors. And this work kind of deals with all of those things.
Amazing.
And that blew my mind.
Yeah.
And it blew my mind, not in a way where I kind of berated myself and thought, oh, why did I do that when I should have done? It was just like, oh, it's so easy.
What you don't know, do you?
How would you know that? And the beauty of it is I don't believe that you can think yourself out of a feeling state. You have to feel it. So the beauty of it is that your body senses it first. And then your brain can make sense of it. So what this work does is it introduces new experiences to your nervous system, because how you think and how you respond to things is all based on your past experiences, which is kind of wild, isn't it? Although we're always told, aren't we, about meeting things in the moment, and meditation can bring, you can meet it in the moment. Well, I had a meditation practice of 25 years, and I don't know about you, but, you know, it was only in the last 2 minutes of my meditation practice, I'd be like, oh yeah, I've gone. And all the other times I'd have little thoughts about, oh, the gas bill, got to get my blow dry appointment in, or whatever it was. Do you know what I mean? So even that, I think, felt like a little bit of a pretense.
It's really interesting because I've had lots of meditation practices and different things. And there has been moments where I had bliss and, oh, this is it. But when I would leave the mat or the place or whatever, I'd be back in to the game.
Yeah.
And I was confused about if I'm meditating, how am I not bringing that into daily life? Now, it does help completely.
Yeah.
And it really helped understand what I was thinking.
Yeah, of course.
How I'd picture stuff and all those things.
Our culture teaches us that there is one thing we must all aspire to, but one thing doesn't suit all of us. Yeah. Generally, meditation practitioners or teachers, that's all they do.
Mm.
That's how they make their living. So they're doing it a lot. They have a lot of practice and they have a lot of time to drop into it. That's been their lifelong kind of practice, right? Most people don't live that life.
Yeah.
So expecting somebody to go from being sedentary to then sitting on the floor cross-legged, having no thoughts, is quite a big ask.
It's huge.
Because what you haven't done is you haven't dealt with the tension in your body first.
Mm.
Now, if you think about it, meditation came from communities of men living in monasteries. So all they had to do was to cook together, clean together, and then sit and meditate. They were moving a lot in the day. So all, you know, they were kind of moving, their joints were prepared, their cortisol was constantly being released from their body, and that prepared them to sit. So it's quite a big ask, I think, to ask, you know, the normal kind of person who sits in an office every day to sit and meditate. And I think that sets people up for failure. So if you kind of have an understanding of actually, who am I? What, you know, to kind of better your relationship with yourself, so you really understand yourself, and then you can figure out what you need. And it might be meditation and it might well be yoga, but it also might not. There might be other things that kind of make up, I sort of call it a soothing toolkit for yourself.
When you're in the fast lane, the last thing you want to do is to pull over into the slow lane.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Because it's very frustrating because you come up against yourself a lot. And only from my experience, I can say that I didn't want to slow down because if I slowed down, I'd have to look at myself.
Yeah.
I didn't want to slow down because I was scared of what I'd see.
Of course.
And there's lots of narratives to stop you going in. How do you guide people into that?
So by the time people get to me, they're quite broken. They've either had a burnout or, you know, something's happened that they had to seek help and they've tried everything else. You know, they've tried talking therapies, which is great for contextualizing, rationalizing, externalizing. Mm. And it gives you some good tools. But again, if you your body doesn't sense safety, you know, you're still going to have those same feelings, those same sensations in your body. Everyone, I guess, comes to me with a little bit of skepticism, but they're quite desperate. You know, they need to fix this. And as soon as they feel that first session, they're like, okay, I understand how this can work. And I'm constantly explaining how it works and why it works and what just happened to them as well. So they feel they have that safety of kind of knowing this
isn't... Which is really important.
Yeah, and this isn't kind of something that someone's giving me. Because I think our relationship with teachers, students, is that someone tells you what to do and you obey. This is not that work at all.
Yeah.
Like, I actually don't call myself a coach. Not that I think it's wrong. I call myself an educator. Because that's what I'm doing. I'm educating your nervous system to kind of organize itself so that you can be self-sufficient.
I always said, is it chicken or egg where emotions bring the thought, or is it thought that can bring the emotion? Because if you mention the word spider to my mother, she'll be like a crazy person for 5 minutes.
She will, but it'll be her body that responds first, I bet. So that's really interesting, actually, because, again, the thing that really blew my mind, and it's from a neuroscientist called Lisa Feldman Barrett, is that when you are meeting the moment, you're not actually meeting the moment. It's a combination of past experiences with current physical sensations.
Past experiences from your nervous system.
From your nervous system. Yeah. With your current sensation. It's a meeting of those two things. Your brain either course corrects it or confirms it. When you can introduce a little bit of a gap to go, actually, am I feeling safe right now? I am safe. So the thing that's going on for me is a psychological unsafety. Yeah?
Which makes sense,
which is our world really, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's mainly psychological kind of dangers rather than a saber-toothed tiger.
Yeah, because you can sit on your couch worrying about something tomorrow and get completely anxious and you haven't left your...
Well, actually, I was even thinking about the journey that I took to go here. And in a matter of, you know, however long it took to get here, I had just gone across the whole world with all the problems going on in the whole world. Then my immediate family, then what's going on in the house that I left the 3 dogs in. And do you know what I mean? I had been through a whole range of emotions.
Yeah.
And I remember just thinking, I'm just going to shut this down and I'm just going to look out the window because actually my brain needs a rest. So our psychological dangers are relentless and ongoing, aren't they?
Yeah.
And your body is responding to that all of the time. So, you know, I often say to my clients, we're really good at contracting. We're just not so good at letting go. You know, fast twitch fibers contract because they're getting you ready to run or fight. Most of us freeze. In our culture, most of us freeze. And interesting, when you're on your laptop with the back of the neck like that and your shoulders up here, that's a freeze response. You are mimicking the freeze response. So your brain just thinks, I'm in danger. So you're kind of undoing all of those relentless things that are happening even before you get to a yoga practice or a meditation practice. It's all of the other things that are going on for you that you kind of need to slowly unpick and unravel. And that's what changes habits. So back to your question of like, how do I get these busy people? Well, they're always in their heads. They're desperate when they come to see me. I have very good rationale for what I'm doing. I explain it well. And then they actually feel different. And then they're like, oh, I've never actually felt like this before.
Yeah, so the experience
It's experience. And once you do that, so once you drop your shoulders, not by stretching, but that signal from your brain to your muscle, your nervous system now has a completely different experience of your shoulder. When it's up here, it just checks out, goes back into your base stem, that becomes your brain stem, that becomes the habit. And your brain thinks, well, I don't need to really check in with that because that's what we do all the time. That's what we need to do. That's a function of the shoulder. But when I, you know, when I kind of guide you into, well, what would it feel like if it was here? And what about here? And what about down here? And then your nervous system goes, actually, that feels really much better.
Yeah.
And so it chooses to do that. And you can completely change your posture and your physicality by releasing, not by stretching.
I love what you just said about the journey here, because I think people that have genuine experience and have agency now on their bodies or their minds and stuff can say that, where people who are trying to be someone won't admit that the brain itself and the mind can go everywhere, but you're watching it and then you can bring it back.
Absolutely. And that's really important. And I was thinking about that the other day, about the people that you believe in and the people that you don't. And the people that I mean, in terms of teachers or people call themselves gurus or whatever, the people that are open and willing to be vulnerable, I will believe in them. And the people that are just like, no, this practice that I do and this kind of supplements that I sell is the answer, you just think, life isn't like that. I don't believe you.
Only when you're awake.
Yeah, of course.
Because I think when people are slightly scared or maybe desperate or whatever, we'll go, oh, they seem powerful, let's take their product.
You're right. But if you're smart, it doesn't take long, does it, to kind of suss out that someone's a bit of a charlatan?
No, you're absolutely right.
And, you know, and I'm actually thinking about somebody famous right now who was lauded as a bit of a guru, and loads of kind of hotels had him heading up festivals. And you just thought, what are you doing? He's a complete charlatan.
I'm probably thinking of the same person who you can read clearly. Yeah.
But it was known. It was known by everybody, and it was known in all of those circles. So I'm not sure where it suddenly was, you know, got veiled and he was elevated to that status. Because actually, we were all scratching our heads going.
Because I think that probably the people booking those people just want the tickets, bums on the seats.
You're
to
right.
Browse.
And you're absolutely right.
And it's almost like, let's just do it anyway to get our brand in or something like that. And I think that is very, very dangerous.
I think you're absolutely right. And actually, again, that takes me back to the point of how do the clients trust me if they're kind of used to having, you know, kind of quite a high level of service and getting what they want and buying into things and da, da, da. I think it's because you can tell, you can feel it. You feel it. I'm not telling you something. You actually sense it in your own body. And then that taps you into something much, much deeper.
Well, there's an authenticity.
Yeah.
And you talked openly about puffing, and we spoke the other day and you said you smoked since you was 14.
I know.
And again, I love the honesty because, again, when you don't hide anything, you prove organically that you've come from there to here, and it's not a stain on the dress, you know.
Yeah, it's very funny because I think men in this world can say it much more easily than women.
Do you think so?
Yeah, I do. I think a lot of the editors are just like, oh, I really admire your honesty. And I was just like, well, it's true. That's what we did.
Yeah.
And interesting, actually, when I talked to you the other day, when I came off the phone, I just thought, actually, I remember at school, I went to a state school in Southfields, and I remember thinking, there's lots of us without a dad around at the time, and we were all puffing. It was just what we did. You just didn't talk about it. It was just kind of like, have that, make you feel better. It's like, oh yeah, it does.
It's funny, isn't it? Because the way you say it, it's very inoffensive.
Yeah.
And sometimes when guys say it, it's a bit more like gangstery and a bit more we used to do that, but it sounds like quite nice and fluffy.
It was quite I mean, everything's okay until it's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Until it's a problem, then it becomes a real problem. But of course, people are drawn to things because it numbs them. Because actually, the world is beautiful and brutal.
Well, if you listen to any of the old poets, they'll tell you how tough it can be.
Yes, of course. Well, they're the truth seers, aren't they? Yeah. Artists and people who see the world as it really is, and are willing to talk about it.
They are, and it's incredible. And it's, I was never into the arts as a kid. My dad will still say, why would you go to the theatre? Why would you listen to whatever musical? And I went for years to educate myself on stuff because I thought wrongly at the time that that was like a weak kind of area and it's just all nonsense. But it's incredible through art, music, great movies. You can learn so much.
Yeah, you can. And also, why should we just live a life where our basic needs are met? Yeah. We are so much more than that. You know, we all have such huge amount of potential and it's just not being tapped. I mean, actually, when you were talking about the work that you do, I kind of wanted to cry a little bit because, you know, all the people I went to school with and my family and the people that I see and the people that need help, and you just say, why can't you go to the theatre? Why can't you draw and do art and dance and just fulfil your life? Why must your life be drudgery? And actually, that's really funny. A friend of mine who I went to school with, she went to a palmist once, and the palmist said to her, do you know what? Your life is going to be one of drudgery. And it was.
You're
what
joking.
A terrible thing to
did
say.
Did she pay them?
She did pay them. But actually, she's had a really beautiful, you know, she always seeks beauty out. Yeah. But, you know, what a thing to say. But
good.
I know. But I just kind of think, like, why should everyone's life be painful or punishment?
There was one sentence that I used to hear a lot as a child, and it was, we'll manage. And I always thought, I'm never going to manage. Yeah. Why do I want to manage?
Yeah.
I want
Great.
To thrive. So when you gave up huffing, why did you?
Because I realised, I was about 30, I think. Was I 30 or late 20s? And I just realised that other people didn't do it. I was just like, oh. Not everyone seems to need to have this sort of crutch. But I got into the rave scene.
Yeah.
So I was quite heavily into that. So yeah, I had to give up the puff because just nobody else was doing it. It just looked a bit strange. And I got a bit curious about, you know, doing lots of movement things. I didn't want to smoke. So I just got really curious about what else could I do? What could I do that would sustain me? And I think the reason I was never an addict was because I was very interested in getting into things. But then I was really interested in asking the question, well, what happens if I don't do this anymore?
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? So I've had really intense bouts of practically everything.
I remember having anxiety more than I ever thought I did. And it started to come when I just thought I was fast and hyper.
Yeah.
And when I come into recovery and I put everything down and went fully into different meditations and different things. And again, I was doing it, but it wasn't sitting still. It was the going towards to do something to change the way I am.
Yeah.
And it took me quite a while. And I was in LA about 5 years sober. I think I was 4 years sober. And I would get lumps here from anxiety.
Mm.
And I just couldn't work it out. I'd see acupuncturists. I'd see healers.
Mm.
I went to loads of different people. And I just kept asking myself, is it because I'm going into an industry that my body doesn't want me to go into? Because people have always said, oh my God, your face should be on the screen.
Mm.
You've done so much modeling, you should be an actor. God, you're great at commercial, you should be an actor. And really I was doing something driven from someone else.
Yes, yeah.
So there was an inauthenticity. That's what I think. Could I have done it and done very well? Yes, I think I could have done. But personally, behind the scenes, I was getting so unhappy and felt so cap in hand. I didn't like the energy I was in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Actually, I have a thing about that. When your inner world matches your outer world, you're in a really good place.
Yeah.
And most of us have an outer world that just doesn't match their inner world at all. And I've been there. Do you know what I mean? And then that's where the dissonance is.
Yeah.
That's where the suffering is, I think, isn't it?
It is suffering, yeah. I think it's such a big journey from doing things, I can just speak for me, what I thought I wanted to do, but realizing it's what I thought you wanted me to do.
Yeah.
And sitting in my own body, do it. Like, now's a brilliant time for me. I love being a dad. I love looking after my kids. Love being a husband. And I feel like I've taken agency on what I want to do.
Mm.
And I catch myself sometimes seeing like a friend in a movie going, shit, I should have, what have I... And I'll meet them and they're complete and anxious mess. I think, thank you.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And actually, that's really interesting because one of my clients, many of my clients, but this one in particular that I'm thinking about is a barrister. And that's what her father was and that's what she went into. And she came to see me because she'd had several burnouts. And she said, I think I just never wanted to be a barrister, but everyone expected me to. Mm. And I was like, wow, you're just going into court having men shout at you all the time. And she, that just sent her whole system into complete frenzy.
Yeah.
And actually, she could use the skills that she has and move into something else. And so the work that I do with her, it's got her moving into more writing about the legal system and, you know, her particular area in the industry. Mm. And so, again, getting to find out about yourself, what makes you tick, what makes you triggered, and then finding the right environment for you. It's kind of never too late for that. But yeah. she used to have a knot here as well. And wow. so what my work does is it's not true that your emotions sit in your body. You know, the body keeps the score. That's been updated. Your brain keeps the score. Your body's the scorecard.
Okay.
So my work, what it does is, it's not true that your emotions sit in your body or your muscles. It's the patterns of that emotion. So her patterns of emotion was just getting very, very tight in the chest
yeah.
and her solar plexus, actually. And then that would then, you know, physically affect her breathing because it would be much shallower. And then she'd go into panic attacks.
Wow.
So it was kind of like, okay, let's kind of figure out what's going on here. And so the first few times that I see people, I'm kind of just looking at their movement patterns. And the things that I'm interested in is the movement, the transmission of forces through your bones, because then that tells me there's no kind of contractions of muscle or soft tissue there. And that how that will have an effect is it will shut down your capillaries and all the blood supply to that area. So wow. that's going to cause some sort of dysfunction. And then I'm also looking at how your whole self accommodates your breathing, because of course, while it's true that oxygen goes into your lungs, you know, the air goes into your lungs, oxygen's carried around your body and then out through carbon dioxide, your whole body is responding to your breathing, unless, of course, you sit down all day.
Yeah.
So you saying about your children going to school, that's when everyone tells me that, I just think, oh, no, they're going to have to sit down all day. It's what I think, because, you know, you have these lovely free spirits who move.
I know.
And they also, you know, kids are like real pure nervous systems, as are dogs and cats in your house. You know, they're pure nervous systems. They're going to tell you when they're angry, hungry, tired. You know, you will know it because there's no filter.
Yeah.
And actually, our nervous systems are exactly the same when we're older. We just think we're sophisticated, and we are, but in a completely different way. If you listen in to those signals, as probably you did in lots of your work, be it writing, thinking about it, meditating on it, and probably quite a lot of movement, it sounds, then you're going to really figure out what is going on physically and in what instances that physicality comes up for you.
Yeah.
And then you can figure out, I'm actually not comfortable in this. These aren't my people. You know, this person makes me feel like this. I don't want to be around them. And it doesn't mean that you avoid things. When you understand what triggers you, what prompts you into that sort of freeze response or whatever, you know, high cortisol, whatever it is, then you can prepare yourself for that. So you're not going in blind.
How do you prepare?
Open-hearted.
Because going, one of the boys, say, for example, they're going on a date.
Yeah.
They're not drinking. They've always drunk or done drugs and they're going on a date.
Yeah.
And I'll say to them, what are you going for?
Yeah.
And they'll be like, well, I want to see if the girl likes me. I want to see this and that. And we break down, ultimately, they want to be liked.
Yeah, lovely.
And some of them want to have a one night stand, or some of them just actually really want to get to know a person. So we'll break it down.
Nice.
And we'll go through sentences of like, I'll give them a mission to do, rather than you're not going there to for her to fall in love with you and take all these things. You're going there to have a nice time, to engage with a person, find out who they are, be interested in them.
Lovely.
And have a fun dinner, and that's it.
Yeah, nice.
And that takes away all the anxiety of like, will they go on a second date? I hope they like me. What's this, you know,
yeah,
all of
lovely.
That stuff.
Yeah.
And try and keep it simple and say to them that you are going to feel anxious, because that's a normal thing to do when you go to meet someone.
Yeah.
But just engage with the person, that will go away.
Yeah.
That's probably basic to what you do.
Yeah.
What would you say?
What would I say? I would probably say go on an outdoors date where you're not sitting opposite each other. Like, having dinner with someone's quite a big number, isn't it?
Yes.
With someone you don't know, having to sit there and make sure food isn't all over your face or in your teeth or down your top. So it's just too much pressure, I think. So go out somewhere, walk, go for a walk. I don't roller skate. What do kids do these days? I don't know.
And what would you say
do something
about
outdoors
the feelings
where you're involved in something? So feelings in terms of feeling anxious.
Yeah, because
I would tell them to shake it out, because Your nervous system understands safety or not, yeah? Safe or unsafe, okay. Yeah? To different degrees. Yeah. That's all it understands. It doesn't know it's anxiety. It doesn't know it's stress because those are social constructs.
Yeah, right? Gotcha.
So the most appropriate thing to do when cortisol rises, when you're a little bit alarmed, is to get rid of it from the body, yeah? A rise of cortisol is your signal to run. It's danger. You know, there's danger ahead. Yeah. But of course, all of our stresses these days generally are psychological. But we're still sitting there with these cortisol peaks constantly all day long. And that's what causes inflammation in the body. That's why there's such a high incidence of kind of inflammatory diseases, because we're sitting down, just getting more and more tense. Tell them to shake it out. And then afterwards, don't forget to let go of that excitement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just let go of it.
It's really, I loved it, what you said in your book, because touch is so important.
So important.
It's really, I remember, for example, I was in the Priory and they let me out after 2 weeks for a haircut. And the hairdresser sat me down. She goes, are you in a Priory up the road? I went, yes. And she put a hand on my shoulder and the warmth from her hand, I just started crying. Yeah. I was like, someone cares. But it was really important because I'd forgot about touch. I was so far removed in my addiction, I forgot about touch. I'm a very tactile person. And it meant so much to me. And sometimes I'll do that myself. I'll just put my hand on my chest and feel the warmth of it and say, I'm okay.
Yeah. And it's very powerful. Yeah. Your brain doesn't know that isn't someone else or you. It's really powerful.
Yeah.
You know? But the sensing it rather than doing it as a practice is really important. There's something very different about that, because now you've taken it out of your mind, making yourself do something. And you're actually feeling your breastbone moving, you're feeling your ribs moving and that slow breath in and out. Or your intention could just be, I come with good intentions.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Or I'm a good person, you know?
Yeah.
It could be whatever it wants, but say it out loud if you can.
If there's someone that is stressed, suffering from anxiety, they're not well-versed in this area, what would you say the first few good steps would be?
There's three important things to do that are really accessible for everyone. Your brain is reassured by two things. One, what time of day is it? Is it the morning or is it the night? So get out first thing and get daylight into your eyes. Yeah, that kicks off all the wake up processes in your brain. So you're making sure that your brain understands where it is in time. The next thing is, where is it located in gravity? Are you on your feet? Is your back against the wall? Are you lying on the floor? All those things will signal safety. So I've had clients ring me up from Paddington Station going, I'm having a panic attack. And I'll be like, get your back against the wall.
Wow.
And they'll go put their back against the wall. So now through sensation on your back, you've got support. Those tight extensor muscles that keep you up in gravity, they're still working, but they sense feedback because your brain doesn't actually understand where you start and where you end. I know you can visually see it, but it has no understanding. It sits in the black box. It knows nothing apart from the experiences you feed it. Yeah? So as soon as your back is against a wall, you can breathe. Or feet on the floor. So often on the tube when people are having, you know, feeling anxious, and I sometimes still do it, I press my feet into the floor going, now I can feel that. Or I might even press in as I breathe in for six, gently release that pressure as I breathe out for six. So you've got circadian rhythm, knowing where you are in the day, knowing where you're located, and then slow breathing. Anything between 5 and 7 breaths per minute has been shown to be the sort of optimal pace of breathing. It's slow, it's regular, it's kind of feeding the system. It's called coherent breathing. And it gives a chance for your brain over time, your brain, your heart, and your lungs come back into the same frequency.
Are they deep breaths?
So think more in terms of low breaths. So your parasympathetic, which is your rest repair nerves, run at the bottom of your lungs. Mm. And your stressor ones, your sympathetic nerves run at the top of the lungs. So if you're breathing up in here, you're just stressing yourself even more. So think low. So another thing you can do is take your fingertips, your low ribs. Mm-hmm. Breathe in slowly for 6 and breathe out slowly for 6. And just keep doing that until your state changes. But it's your feeling it. These are really active parts of you. They have a huge kind of representation in the brain. which forms a body map in your brain of where you are and all the things you regularly do. So if you write with your left hand probably has a bigger representation in your brain than your right hand. Yeah. When these busy parts of you, you slow them down onto your ribs, sensing your breathing, you've got external body informing internal body. And so it works as a feedback loop.
That's incredible.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so simple.
Yeah.
So simple, so accessible.
Naheed, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. It's such a pleasure. I absolutely love what you do. I've had about 2 weeks of deep dive into into your world, and it's moved me to tears and made me smile. And I'm so grateful for people like you putting out the work that you do. So thank you.
Thank you. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholefort and at this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eber Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.